This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We recognize that climate change is happening. The dilemma for society is addressing climate change and balancing it with development. So we have to be realistic. Renewables and alternatives will all play a role, but even if those forms of energy grow by orders of magnitude over, say, the next 50 years, traditional hydrocarbons, oil and gas, will still make up the majority of the energy mix for at least the next century.
That is Shell Oil spokesman Curtis Smith speaking on the Platts podcast, Capital Crude, June 1st, 2015. Curtis Smith was explaining why Shell Oil wants to spend $7 billion looking for more oil in the fragile Arctic. In an internal Shell Oil paper leaked by the Guardian newspaper, the company recognizes that their energy strategy will lead to 4 degrees centigrade of warming, twice the safe limit, and then to 6 degrees of warming, a level scientists suggest could wreck civilization. So they know, and they want to find more carbon to burn anyway. Before you kiss our chances goodbye, there is some really good news from our feature guest this week. Author and financial expert Jeff Rubin says the carbon bubble is already bursting. Governments and mainstream media will hardly tell you, but the markets are already heading for the exits from such stranded fossil assets. The stock values of companies in the mega-polluting Canadian tar sands have fallen by 70%. Coal company stocks are collapsing, down 90%. Stay tuned for a ringside view of a failing petrol state right here on Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
With the tar sands and the crash in oil prices, Canada went from being a world petrol state to an economy in trouble. Our next guest says the carbon bubble is bursting in Canada, and that may not be a bad thing. Jeff Rubin is no ordinary critic of fossil fuels. He was the chief economist for CIBC World Markets, the investment arm of a Canadian megabank. Since then, he's written the books The End of Growth and Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller. Now Rubin has a new work out, The Carbon Bubble, What Happens to Us When It Bursts. Jeff Rubin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, it's good to be on.
Well, now the obvious question, and everybody asks you this right off the bat, I notice, Jeff, what is a carbon bubble?
Well, the bubble is a financial phenomena that we've seen quite often in the last 15 years. We've had about 3 bubbles. There was the dot-com bubble at the turn of the millennium. There was the subprime mortgage market bubble before the last recession, and now there's the carbon bubble, and they all share a common characteristic is that they're all based on some fundamental assumption that turns out to be false. In the case of the carbon bubble, the fundamental implicit assumption is that we can combust and emit as much carbon as we wish. And I think that that's becoming shown to be a falsehood, that there is a limit to how much carbon we can emit into the atmosphere. There's not only a limit, but we're rapidly approaching that limit. And in the future, the global economy is going to be consuming less coal and oil and natural gas than it is today. And, of course, that's a very different demand forecast that graces the business plans of fossil fuel companies, particularly in the Canadian case. The most important would be the oil sand producers.
Okay, so how deeply did the Canadian government, headed by Prime Minister Stephen Harper, lead the country into dependence on what I would call the tar sands of Alberta?
Right. Well, I mean, Canada escaped the worst consequences of the subprime mortgage bubble, but it's probably going to be the epicenter of the carbon bubble because I don't know of any other economy, at least in the OECD, that has staked its economic future and has banked so heavily on the development of its hydrocarbon resources, particularly the oil sands or tar sands, as you call them. The problem with the oil sands is not so much that they are a dirtier form of fuel, that they are more emission intensive than conventional fuel. Their greater problem is that they are one of the highest cost sources of oil in the world. And in a world that's soon going to be combusting less oil, not more oil, they are the most vulnerable to that new regime of lower oil prices and falling world oil demand.
How has dependence on this fossil fuel dream distorted the Canadian economy, Jeff?
Well, it's created huge distortions because while it's created a temporary bonanza in Alberta, it's cast a shadow over the rest of the Canadian economy. The Canadian dollar has always been a resource currency, but in the past, resources meant a whole bevy of goods from wheat to minerals to forestry and oil. But as Canada morphed into a petro-economy, the Canadian dollar morphed into a petro-currency. At one point, we were trading at a premium to the U.S. dollar. That it wasn't an issue for the oil sand producers because their product is U.S. dollar denominated, but it was a huge issue for the rest of the country, from forestry to manufacturing to tourism. The petrodollar decimated huge swaths of the Canadian economy, particularly the manufacturing sector in Ontario and Quebec.
So in terms of economics, what is the Dutch disease and could Canada catch it?
Well, okay, the Dutch disease refers to a phenomena about 30, 40 years ago where the Netherlands all of a sudden started developing oil and nat gas from the North Sea. And the Dutch guilder rose as the Canadian dollar rose, and it rose hugely against the currencies of its trading partners like the French franc and the German Deutschmark. This is well before the euro. And it decimated the manufacturing sector in the Netherlands. There's one fundamental difference between the Dutch disease of the 1970s in the Netherlands and what happened in Canada. The Netherlands is a very small country, so the oil and gas industry is right next to the manufacturing industry. Canada is a huge country, at least geographically, and the oil and gas is in one province, Alberta. So when all of a sudden you price out manufacturing sector, you have a huge shift in economic activity from one part of the country to the other part of the country. The flip side of Alberta's prosperity has been really the weakest performance in central Canada of the entire post-war period.
So Canada has repeatedly been called a carbon dinosaur at international climate meetings. There are charges that Stephen Harper's representatives went to climate talks to make sure real limitations on carbon emissions didn't happen. And Jeff Rubin, can we expect anything better from Canada at the Paris climate talks at the end of this year?
I doubt it. I mean, you can understand, while if you think the oil sands is going to be the engine of economic growth, that you would be in denial of climate change, because once you recognize that carbon emissions are driving climate change and that we have to limit carbon emissions, I mean, that's a very lethal environment for high-cost oil like the oil from the oil sands. I don't think we're going to see anything different in Canada's position at the Paris climate change, but what is different is that the oil bubble is burst and that the petrol economy in Alberta is collapsing right now. And it's led to huge changes both in the value of the Canadian dollar and also in the stock valuations of oil sand companies. So we may not get a global climate change regime that would basically limit the oil sands, but what's happening is that in a world of low oil prices, and the oil price the oil sand producers get is a lot lower than the kind of oil prices that you see in the news media, what's happened is it's very difficult for these companies to access capital in the marketplace.
So what about fracking? How did that affect the tar sands?
Well, you got to realize that the expansion of the oil sands, it's right now about 2 million barrels. It was planned to go to 5 million barrels. That wasn't so people in Calgary and Edmonton and Vancouver could fill up their tanks. Canada produces already almost twice as much oil as the country consumes. Oil consumption in Canada, like oil consumption in the United States, like oil consumption in Europe, peaked about a decade ago. This was all actually for the U.S. market. The U.S. market, while consumption had fallen, production had declined. You know, around 2006, 2007, the U.S. was producing a little more than 5 million barrels a day about half of what it was in the 1970s. But all of a sudden, because of the wonders of fracking or hydraulic fracturing, places like the Bakken in North Dakota, places like Eagle Ford and the Permian Basin in Texas, were producing over a million barrels a day, and U.S. production doubled. And all of a sudden, Canada's bitumen became unwanted, high-cost oil. Hence the need to desperately get pipelines to Tidewater so that we could deliver our oil, load it onto tankers, and sell it to places like China and India.
So has that affected the big pipeline proposals like the Keystone XL or Northern Gateway?
Well, you know, of course, what happened is that after they didn't get approval from Keystone XL, they realized that they better lay pipelines in Canada where they weren't dependent on the Nebraska State Legislature or the Obama administration. All they needed was the approval of the National Energy Board in Canada. And given that the National Energy Board in Canada has never refused a pipeline, that seemed like a pretty safe bet. And I have no doubt that the National Energy Board will rubber stamp all these pipelines like Northern Gateway, like Energy East, like the twinning of the Trans Mountain pipeline that goes from Alberta to Burnaby, BC. But unfortunately, while that's a necessary condition, that's not a sufficient condition. Pipelines today no longer have an economic context. The whole reason for those pipelines was to carry the added production. But the added production going from 2 million to 5 million barrels a day is not happening. Every week we hear about the cancellation of new projects, whether it's the Joslyn mine or the Pierre River mine. These were the very projects that were going to boost Canadian production that was going to fill those pipelines. Today, those pipelines no longer have an economic context. Instead of expansion, the discussion about the oil sands has changed from expansion to sustainability, because it's not clear that at today's oil prices, let alone at tomorrow's oil prices when we have an emission-constrained future, that even the 2 million barrels a day that they're digging up right now is financially sustainable.
And what do you think about the dozens of schemes to build liquid natural gas export terminals on the west coast of Canada and the U.S.? Are they good investments, and will they really happen?
No, I think similarly the goalposts are going to move against them. And let me just tell you a little story from my former life as the chief economist of an investment bank. You know, before the recession, there was a proposal to build an LNG receiving terminal just outside of Quebec City to receive Russian gas, because at that time natural gas, you know, in North America seemed to be running out and we were going to be an importer of natural gas. Well, in the space of 4 to 5 years, all of a sudden that's become economically nonsensical. Natural gas is much cheaper in North America than in Europe, so instead of importing, we would be an exporter. Well, let me tell you now how the goalposts have shifted in places like China, and most of these LNG terminals, whether they're in the United States or Canada, are aimed at delivering LNG to China, where gas used to be, you know, three times as much as in North America. Well, China's just negotiated a year ago this huge natural gas deal with Siberia that will bring West Siberian gas, East Siberian gas into China at lower prices than what China would pay for LNG. So, you know, just as the goalposts have moved against coal in the United States, just as the goalposts have moved against bitumen in Canada, they're also moving against LNG exports.
This is Radio EcoShock with author and former chief economist for CIBC World Markets, Jeff Rubin. We're talking about his new book, The Carbon Bubble, What Happens to Us When It Bursts. Jeff, you say people can save their money while saving the climate. Why would you advise investors to get out of fossil fuels?
Well, in fact, they are. If you look at the value of coal stocks, I mean, it's interesting that recently Stanford University, which has a $18 billion endowment fund, kicked coal stocks out of its portfolio, claiming its social responsibility, but really it could have more adeptly claimed its fiduciary responsibility. The largest coal stocks in the United States, Peabody Energy, Arch Coal, Alpha Resources, all S&P 500 stalwarts, have lost 90% of their market capitalization. In fact, they've been downgraded so much that they're no longer even eligible to be in institutional portfolios like pension plans or endowment funds. Well, something similar has happened to Canadian oil sand stocks, although you'd never recognize that if you were reading the business media in Canada. Oil sand stocks, like if you were to look at the BlackRock's iShares Oil Sands Exchange Traded Fund, which captures all the TSX-listed, that's Toronto Stock Exchange-listed, oil sand producers, they've already lost 70% of their market value. So, I mean, even for those who are not concerned about climate change, before you save the world, you might want to save your portfolio because this has been the worst performing segment of the market.
Your new book, The Carbon Bubble, has a chapter titled Grow Green or Don't Grow. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know that we've always been taught that a fundamental trade-off between doing right for the environment and doing right for the economy, that if we were going to take measures that would aid the environment, it would hurt the economy, and it would cost us jobs. Well, once you impose a carbon constraint, once we realize that there's a limit to how much we can emit, then that turns that relationship on its head. I mean, the only sure-fired way that we know of controlling carbon emissions is to have a recession, because carbon emissions have fallen in every recession, not as a result of policy, just the consequence of the fact that 80% of the world economy is driven by carbon fuels. But once you impose a limit to carbon emissions, once you put the world economy on a so-called carbon budget, then the opposite is true. There's only two ways of proceeding. Either we cannot grow, which most people don't find a palatable option for carbon management, or we grow green. And what do I mean by grow green? I mean, if we want to keep the level of emissions constant and we want to grow our economy as measured by GDP, then what has to happen is that we have to reduce carbon per unit of GDP at the same rate that we're growing GDP. And that's a very different relationship than the relationship we've all been taught in the past.
You also have a chapter on something called mean reversion, and I found that fascinating. It's something we all really need to understand. Could you explain it briefly for us?
Okay, well, mean reversion is a concept in finance. I guess to put it in layman's terms, if you stretch an elastic band, it always snaps back. And what it says is that when things get out of kilter one way, they have a tendency to move to the opposite before reverting back to some long-term average. If I had to give you probably the most dramatic example of mean reversion in Canada, it's the election of an NDP government in Alberta, which would be absolutely unthinkable. I mean, Alberta's been a province that has had conservative government for 40 years, and the conservative government and the oil industry have been indistinguishable. And I think that that's an example of what's happening, that while the oil sands were the engine of economic growth in the Canadian economy, right now they're the biggest brake on the Canadian economy. Not only is Alberta in a recession, but the last national accounts report for the Canadian economy showed the whole Canadian economy actually contracted the last quarter, mainly because of the implosion of investment spending in the oil and gas sector.
Now, I like the coverage of Arctic fossil fuel resources in your new book, and let me play, or rather read you, a quote from Curtis Smith, a Shell oil spokesman, to the Platts Oil podcast called Capital Crude on June 1st. After saying, "We recognize that the climate change is happening," Curtis Smith says, "We have to be realistic. Renewables and alternatives will all play a role, but even if those forms of energy grow by orders of magnitude over, say, the next 50 years, traditional hydrocarbons, oil and gas, will still make up the majority of the energy mix for at least the next century." Jeff Rubin, what's your opinion of this Shell oil position?
Well, if that's true, then we're not going to see a 2-degree change in global temperatures. We're going to see a 3-to-5-degree change in global temperatures, and that's going to be disastrous for the global economy. I don't think that's going to happen because we're already getting feedback from the climate about how we have to change our energy mix. And, you know, if people doubt that or if people are skeptical about that, just look at coal. I mean, if you were to ask, you know, 3 years ago, investors in Peabody Energy or any of the other coal companies would go to sleep every night confident that there would never be a meaningful global agreement on carbon emissions, and they've woken up to a nightmare where they've lost 90% of their share values because for very different reasons, major coal-consuming countries like China and the United States have taken decisive action against coal, and I think in the future, decisive action will be taken against oil and, in time, natural gas too, particularly shale gas.
You do have some good news for Canada in your new book. You say bursting the carbon bubble could actually be a good opportunity for the country. Tell us about that.
It could be an enormous opportunity, and Prime Minister Harper may ultimately be right in thinking that Western Canada, particularly the prairie provinces, will be the engine of economic growth for the whole country. But it won't be, that engine won't be fueled by bitumen. That engine will be all about agriculture. We won't be the energy superpower that he envisions, but we just might become the world's breadbasket. And if you think about how climate change is going to impact food prices, and it's already impacting food prices, and how climate change is going to impact oil prices, and is already impacting oil prices, that's a very value-added change for us to make. I mean, you turn up the thermostat 3 degrees, as is projected by the middle of this century in places like the Peace River and the Western Prairies, and you turn that into a breadbasket. I mean, it's always been a breadbasket, but you incredibly increase crop yields. You change what can be grown. All of a sudden, you can grow corn and soybean. And at the same time, you turn up the thermostat 3 degrees in Iowa, Illinois, Kansas, and California, and you have the opposite conditions, that you're going to see that agriculture is going to move to high-latitude regions, and Canada is going to be one of the biggest beneficiaries. In fact, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the UN scientific advisory body, as well as like the U.S. Space Agency, NASA, has identified the Canadian prairies as a climate change hot zone where you're going to see temperature changes a multiple of the global averages and profound changes in flora and fauna. I mean, we're already seeing that with, you know, grizzly bears now mating with polar bears because polar bears are migrating much farther south because of the change in climate and ecology. I don't really deal with that in my book, but what I do deal with is agriculture. I mean, you're going to be extending growing seasons 3 to 4 weeks in the Western prairies, and at the same time, you're probably looking at drought conditions in the U.S. I mean, certainly you look at California, which is the U.S.'s number one agricultural producer, we're already seeing that's going to be quickly unsustainable.
And I remember a few years ago when mega investor Jim Rogers said people should invest in farmland. I thought he was a bit out there, but now it's happening. We've got sheikhs and big pension funds and Chinese corporations buying up farmland all over the world, including in Canada. What do you think about this trend, and will there be room left for real Canadian farmers?
Well, I mean, it's funny that you say that. The Canada Pension Plan Investment Board, which is one of the largest pools of money in Canada, bought the Assiniboine Farmland Trust for $120 million, bought thousands and thousands of acres of farmland in the Western Prairies. You saw the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund take a position in the Canadian Wheat Board. Now, the province of Saskatchewan has just declared a moratorium on institutional money buying farmland, and what that really reflects is a schism in the farm community. If you're a young farmer and you want to increase your acreage, you don't want to be competing with $230 billion pension funds. On the other hand, if you're an older farmer, and 70% of the farmers on the Canadian prairies are over 50 years old, you want all the institutional money possible to come into the prairie farmland. I think that as climate change continues to unfold, more and more investors, not just in Canada, but in the U.S. and around the world, are going to see the Canadian prairies as a hedge against the kind of conditions they saw in the U.S. Midwest in the drought in 2012 and the kind of conditions that we're seeing in California right now where municipalities are being forced to cut back their water supply by 25%.
Your book, Carbon Bubble, is mainly about Canada, but it did get me thinking about fossil-dependent Middle East countries, Norway, even the U.S., which is trying to frack its way back into an oil and gas superpower. Is this really a global carbon bubble that is about to burst?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I looked at Canada, but this is not just about Canada. I mean, Canada is maybe, you know, a special case in the sense that few other governments have bet the future of their country on hydrocarbon resources. But let me talk a little bit about, you know, who is likely to survive in the global oil industry. I mean, if world oil demand has to fall by 15% in the next 15 years, that obviously means low oil prices. It's not going to be the shale producers in the Bakken or Eagle Ford or the bitumen producers in Alberta oil sands who are going to survive. It's the low-cost producers. It's Saudi Arabia and OPEC who's going to survive because they have the lowest cost of production. But it's even interesting that economies like Saudi Arabia are now making massive billions of dollars of investment in solar power.
And I worry that Wall Street, the biggest banks, all our pension funds are totally dependent on the fossil fuel economy. Can we survive the end of the carbon age without going through a terrible financial crash?
Well, I'm suggesting that even though you don't really read about it in the business media, certainly not in the business media in Canada, we've already had a financial crash. I mean, when coal stocks in the United States lose 90% of their value, when oil sand stocks in Canada lose 70% of their value, that's in the scale of the subprime mortgage crisis. That's in the scale of the implosion of the dot-com and what happened to the NASDAQ. I'm suggesting that the crash is already happening. I mean, I pointed out at the end of the book, I spent the last couple of months of the book changing tenses because things that I was talking about that would happen in the future were already happening. At one point, I think West Texas Intermediate had fallen as low as $40 a barrel when I was writing. Certainly Western Canadian Select, which is the price that most oil sand producers get, that's basically what they're looking at and even lower.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. Is there anything else you'd like to add or a message you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, again, only, I mean, this would be a message for Canadian listeners and particularly for Western Canadian listeners. You know, our government's denial of climate change, even when meteorologists working for the federal government are told not to mention climate change. You know, it's not just that we've doubled down on a resource that the rest of the world is shorting. It's that we've really turned a blind eye to the economic opportunities that climate change will bring. Sure, there will be lots of costs and lots of challenges and adjustments, but as a high-latitude country that Canada is, I think there's going to be all kinds of economic opportunities, from commercial shipping in an ice-free Northwest Passage to a resurgence of hydroelectric power as the pendulum ultimately swings against shale gas, to the prospects of becoming one of the world's breadbaskets at a time that food probably will be our most valuable commodity.
This is Radio EcoShock with our expert guest, author Jeff Rubin. His new book, The Carbon Bubble, What Happens to Us When It Bursts, tells us about a Canadian economy in transition and a fossil fuel world in trouble. Follow Jeff at his site, JeffRubinsSmallerWorld.com, and find more links to this discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Jeff, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. We are not alone on this earth experiencing a rapid shift of climate. Our next guest is a voice for the wild and what we must do. A new study in the journal Science finds climate change could push into extinction one out of every six plants and animals on this planet. That's a huge, unimaginable loss. A climate shift won't respect the boundaries of parks and wilderness areas we've set aside. Can we just step back and watch? Emma Maris says no. She's been a reporter for the journal Nature and has a master's in science writing from Johns Hopkins University. Her controversial book is titled Rambunctious Garden, Saving Nature in a Post-Wild World. Just lately, Emma stirred up another storm among some naturalists with a provocative article in Orion magazine. From Klamath Falls, Oregon, Emma Maris, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this idea of a post-wild world sounds scary to me. What do you mean by that?
Well, in a way, I suppose a subtitle on a popular trade book is meant to be a bit provocative. Because there certainly is still wildness in the world, and there always will be as long as we, let certain places go wild. But the wild places, the wildernesses are, I think, changing a little bit. They are becoming a little less familiar. What I mean by post-wild, in a way, is that there is a sort of a paradox about wildness that has asserted itself in the 21st century. And that is that the places that we think of as being really wild, like Yellowstone or some of the big national parks and provincial parks, those places are actually getting more and more attention and management to keep them looking the way that we want them to look. So there's a lot of people doing a lot of really good and hard work to take out non-native species and to try to figure out what to do about climate change to keep these places looking the way we expect them to look. Meanwhile, there are other places that are not being managed, that are really kind of going wild. Those places are actually changing quite rapidly. A lot of species from other places are moving in. Climate change is changing what thrives and what doesn't thrive. And so those places that we think of as kind of weedy and trashy, you know, under some definitions, those weedy, trashy places are wilder than some of our most landmark protected areas.
Okay, well now getting to the climate change, we always talk about it in human terms. How soon will Miami go underwater? How bad is the heat going to affect our agriculture? How bad do you think climate change will hit the natural world?
I think that that is really hard to predict. I do think that the predictions are improving. When we first started asking these questions, I was covering this as a journalist, and there was a sort of envelope model where you just put a circle around where the species was, and then you said, if the conditions changed so much, that where would that envelope move as the climate changed, and would the species be able to keep up? But species are not completely without their adaptive characteristics. They can adapt a little bit just as they are, and in some cases they can even evolve fast enough to track some of this. So we may see some surprises. Maybe some things that we don't expect to be hit hard will be. Maybe some things that we expect to go extinct will survive in unexpected places. It's just really hard to predict, but I do think we are right to be very concerned.
I think another problem is people look at it as individual species. They say, well, okay, if this particular bird moves north, it'll go so far, but what about the bugs that it was eating and all the interrelationships? Things move together.
Right. So in some cases, things might move together. In other cases, things might move so that they no longer overlap, and if they rely on each other, that could be a big problem. The same thing occurs not only in space, but also in time. So if there's a tree that leafs out at a certain type of year, and then that is a food resource for a certain caterpillar, if the leaf out happens earlier and earlier, but the caterpillars continue to be born at the same time, they might wake up to a leaf that's too tough for them to eat. So there's mismatches in time and space that could potentially be problematic. But again, we are learning more and more about how much these species can and cannot adapt, so making really precise predictions is very difficult.
Let's take the example you raised in your Orion article and podcast, the whitebark pine. Tell us about this odd-looking tree and why it matters.
So the whitebark pine is a very interesting member of the pine family. It is a high-altitude specialist. It grows high up on mountaintops and ridges, and it often, in its maturity, looks sort of spectacularly twisted, and parts of the bark have been stripped off to reveal a kind of a shiny white surface underneath, and it often has large bowls from frost damage. So it can be really sort of beautiful as it clings to life in this extreme place at the very top of the tree line. Unfortunately, throughout the West, the whitebark pines are being really hit hard by two different pests. Bark beetles, which are native but seem to have been sort of released by climate change to be nastier than they would otherwise be, and a blister rust, which is non-native, which was introduced by humans. So under these two threats, the whitebarks are really struggling, and there's a lot of concern that extinction is a possibility. And I write in the piece about Orion about differing ideas about what should be done about that.
And you also write, quote, in 1903, a few years before Theodore Roosevelt declared Grand Canyon a national monument, he urged Americans to, quote, leave it as it is. You cannot improve on it. The ages have been at work on it, and man can only mar it. I generally agree, but you don't. Why?
Well, because I'm worried about these extinctions. So the basic point is that human beings have changed the planet radically, not only in places where it's really obvious, like cities, but also in places where it's not so obvious to the casual viewer, that even in places that seem really wild, we've changed the climate, and that has really put a lot of pressure on those ecosystems. So I feel as if these human changes give us a certain amount of responsibility for the species that we have put at risk. Now, the whitebark pine is a good case study for this because a lot of the whitebark pines that exist in wilderness areas, either places that just seem wild or places that in the U.S. that have been designated as wilderness. So in those places, it's really tough. You don't want to be around messing around too much in these wilderness areas because you want them to remain wild. You don't want to be fiddling around and planting things and uprooting things and girdling competing trees and so on. But on the other hand, there's a real risk that if you don't go into these wilderness areas and start planting some rust-resistant pines, which there's been some efforts to do, or start girdling and cutting back some competing trees that are kind of smothering these whitebark pines, there's a real risk that you might actually lose the whole species. So I guess, you know, it's not always the case, but it is sometimes the case that you have to choose between wilderness and species survival. When faced with that decision, I guess I just really come down on the side of species survival, and I'll tell you why. It's because those species are this real other thing that we need to make sure continue to exist in the world. The world is not all about us. Now, you would say that wilderness is also trying to keep that value alive, the value of places being without us. But paradoxically, I see wilderness as a real human creation because it's all about us. I mean, it's about us not being in a place. It's about a place being human-free. The whole definition of wilderness is contingent on whether or not people are there. So I actually see it as kind of navel-gazing and narcissistic to obsess about wilderness and whether or not we are there. I think we should be less concerned about our relationship with nature and more concerned about the species themselves, that these species continue to exist. I mean, ultimately, the whitebark pine doesn't care whether or not it's in a wilderness area or whether it's in a parking lot. It wants the sunshine. It wants to thrive. It wants to reproduce. I mean, wants. This is a tree. But that's, you know, metaphorically speaking, I think the species is more important than the relationship.
So what is a conservation-reliant species?
So this is a term that was coined by the conservation biologist Michael Scott. And the idea here is that, you know, and there's a lot of degrees of conservation reliance, probably you could argue. But the idea here is to kind of delineate a group of species that are going to need our help for the foreseeable future because things have changed so much for them that they cannot just survive on their own without continued human intervention. So the classic example is the California condor. California condor, if we stop funding the California condor programs that are currently in place to supplement the population and to train them to avoid power lines and to try to convince hunters not to use lead shot and all these programs, if we stop them, the bird would almost certainly go extinct. So it is reliant on our continued involvement in its life. You know, I don't love that. I wish that we could just set these species free, we could build up their populations to the point where they were healthy, and we could just walk away and let them be wild and free. But there's a fairly decently sized group of species, not just the condor, but some birds and butterflies that require some burning that we have to do on a regular basis, certainly some species in areas where there's cats and foxes and exotic non-native predators that need to be controlled. All of these species are reliant on us never wavering in our continued attempts to keep them going. And those species, you know, we have to choose between having them be wild and having them exist. And we seem to have chosen that we would prefer to have them exist.
So, Emma, how do you see Dave Foreman's call for rewilding or billionaire Ted Turner's introduction of bison and predators into his vast land holdings?
I think these are great. I think they're wonderful programs. I think it's a real reintroduction of lost species is not only sort of good conservation science because you're kind of putting back together missing pieces of ecosystems, but it's also just a really hopeful, wonderful gesture. rather than just being defensive about trying to stop future loss, these rewilding projects add, you know, they kind of take a system that has an X amount of species and X amount of excitement and beauty, and they make it more biodiverse and more beautiful and more exciting. So I think they're wonderful. I must admit, quite taken by some of the Pleistocene rewilding proposals that would have us bring back some species that maybe we lost more than 10,000 years ago in North America. You know, you have to evaluate each one on its own merits, and you have to decide, up, you know, there's not that much money in conservation, so you have to decide where to put your resources. But I think that they're great.
This is Radio EcoShock. We are talking with nature writer and author Emma Morris about our need to intervene to save natural things from climate change. Emma, what is meant by the term new environmentalism?
I don't know. I wrote Rambunctious Garden because I was a journalist following changes in the field of conservation biology. It's really a piece of reporting. I report on a bunch of different conservation biologists who are going in interesting directions, trying new things, and I found them inspiring, and they made me more optimistic about our future than I had been before I started following their work. And around the same time as the book came out, there were some other groups of people and other individuals who were making arguments that were somewhat similar to mine as far as trying to refocus the environmental movement on imagining a good future rather than being kind of more obsessed with returning to this sort of past. So this sort of loose group of people who had similar ideals has been too irresistible to the journalists of the world, and I can't blame them because I'm one of them myself, so I understand how they think. It's been just so irresistible to lump them together and to try to make a movement out of it. I don't think it really was an organic movement. However, the whole thing, the sort of new environmentalists, I don't really know what to think of it. Apart from anything else, I feel like I'd have to sit down and read every single thing that everybody else who's supposedly a new environmentalist ever wrote before I decide whether I want to be called a new environmentalist or not. It's just a category I don't know about. But there seems to be a lively conversation going on in the field of conservation and about what the emphasis should be, how we should orient the field, and what kind of things we should be doing. It's a little dismaying sometimes because the dispute, the sort of discussion, the conversation can get a little bit heated and a little bit harsh. And that's really a shame because really, everybody on both sides or all sides or whatever, there's probably 15 sides of discussion about how conservation should move forward. We all are really on the same side. We all care about the non-human world. We all want to see open space preserved. We're all in favor of large protected areas. I mean, the list of the things we agree on is a mile long, and the list of things that we disagree on is really quite short. So it is perhaps a bit dismaying that there's been so much acrimony. I think we're all on team nature here.
Yeah, in the comments on your article at Orion Magazine, some writers say they've been practicing what you preach for decades. And, for example, Kieran Suckling, the executive director at the Center for Biological Diversity, says this new environmentalism isn't new at all. So how do you respond to that?
Well, it's always interested me that perhaps the two most common criticisms of my writing have been that what I'm proposing is heresy and that what I'm proposing is old news. So I don't know which one it is. I guess it depends on how you read it. Kieran is the head of an incredibly powerful and effective conservation group that really takes the government to task on, the U.S. government to task on protecting endangered species. And he does a lot of really good work. I almost wish that he would, you know, spend more time suing the U.S. government and less time leaving comments on my articles. but he's somebody, you know, who should definitely be respected.
And who do you find in your corner agreeing with your views on saving what's left of nature?
Oh, all sorts of people. I very frequently receive emails from people who are land managers who found themselves for many years in a kind of a tough place where they found that they were trying to manage their park or their preserve or their area to a certain reference condition or baseline, and they were finding that more and more difficult as the climate was changing and as non-native species were sort of knocking at the door and trying to come in. And in a lot of cases, you know, I think part of what I write about is that it's very difficult to choose an appropriate baseline in many cases. We don't have all the information about what the system used to look like before it was changed. And more sort of fundamentally, ecosystems are not static entities. They change all the time through time. So you kind of have to pick a time that you want to go back to, and it's not always obvious which is the right time to go back to. So this has been a real struggle for some managers, and I often hear from them that they found a certain amount of relief in realizing that, you know, that another option was to figure out what they and the community and the ecosystem could look like in the future that would be valuable and biodiverse and that would protect our species and do all these wonderful things, but wouldn't necessarily have to look exactly like it did in 1850 or some particular date. So that's been really liberating, I think, for a lot of people, and I get a lot of fan mail from land managers, which I find, of course, incredibly gratifying.
Well, of course, one big worry is that your proposal could open the door to less sensitive or ethical people for a justification for developing the parks or managing aspects of nature we don't understand very well. I mean, humans are known for their hubris and natural failures. Can we overcome that?
Yeah, I think that's a really legitimate concern. You know, my issue is, what is the alternative? You know, if our paleoecology and our historical ecology is telling us that there was no one perfect state for any ecosystem, you know, that things have been changing, that they've been managed by humans far before Europeans showed up and back into prehistory, and that there's no sort of perfect Garden of Eden moment for most systems, you know, we have to listen to what they're saying. We have to follow the science on this. You know, my other sort of standard reply to this argument is that, you know, it hasn't really stopped developers in the past not to have this argument up their sleeve. They tend to kind of make arguments that are much more focused on, well, this will create jobs, or this will be good for the community, and I think those are probably going to be the arguments that they will continue to use in the future. You know, whether you have to use a historical baseline or whether you can restore to some alternative condition that's premised on biodiversity, it's a little bit of an arcane distinction, I think, for somebody who's trying to build a mall. But I think it is a legitimate worry. It's just that I don't believe in pretending, right? I mean, pretending that there is one right state for a particular ecosystem. It seems misleading. The scientists who study this have sort of moved beyond that framework, and that's what Kieran has always said in his comments on my pieces, that this is not how conservation actually takes place, that they don't look up exactly what an ecosystem looked like in 1850 and then painstakingly recreate it as if it was a work of art. That's not really what goes on. So in a way, what I'm just trying to do is have us talk openly about the way we really do conservation, which is a more forward-looking enterprise and can be more sort of hopeful and optimistic and less about trying to stop loss.
You know, it's interesting to compare environmentalism in the United States with Canada or Europe, where we also broadcast. In Europe, there's practically no original wild space at all, so the discussion there is quite different. And here in Canada, there's so much wilderness, there is no hope or idea that humans could or should manage it. How do you see your proposals for gardening in nature resonating in other parts of the world?
Well, generally speaking, I find that there are a few places that sort of think like the U.S. on this, and one is Australia, and another is many of the Pacific Islands, New Zealand also. So any place where Europeans sort of showed up, got off a boat, and said, look at this virgin wilderness, that sort of set up a kind of a false premise for a lot of places, that there was this sort of unpeopled wilderness that you could then protect or return to. It's a little bit of a sort of a historical construct. Whereas in places like Africa and Europe and Asia, there's been people continuously in these ecosystems for so many thousands of years that it's not this sort of notion that you could find a place without people. It doesn't occur or appeal or have the same kind of romantic resonance. So, yeah, I mean, I once gave a talk in the Netherlands and to a bunch of ecology students, and after I gave my talk, they were kind of like, yeah, so? This is exactly how we've always done things here. You know, sort of saying, okay, here's a piece of land. You know, what kind of good work can we do here? What kind of species conservation can we do here? So, yeah, it's definitely different. And Canada is an interesting case. I mean, it certainly, Canada has myth of the idea that, that all of this was virgin wilderness when the first people arrived, the first European people, rather. But clearly that's not the case. I mean, there's been people living in Canada for thousands of years, and they have done a lot of things on the landscape, from, you know, managing game populations through hunting, to burning, to planting camas bulbs and then harvesting them in certain designated areas. It's sort of a huge amount of human management going way back. You know, some of the places that I visited in Canada for the book were interesting because what they were really restoring to was to that indigenous management. You know, there's some Gary Oak Savannah preserves on Vancouver Island, for example, that I talk about in my book. Really beautiful places with Gary Oaks and then a carpet of camas underneath. And those were essentially those were human-created ecosystems because they were kept open from incursion by Doug Furs by kind of maintaining them through fire. So in a way, we've already been doing this. We've already been restoring to states that we like as humans that are kind of collaborations between humanity and nature.
So where does this discussion go from here? Emma, what do you want to see changed?
You know, my original book was a bit of reporting, and I've done some reporting on these kinds of topics since. The change is happening. We don't need to pass any law or change anything. I think that as climate change moves species around, there are going to be some real legal challenges in the various national versions of endangered species rules and acts, because we have a kind of a legal framework that species occur in a certain area and they don't really move. But they're going to be moving as the climate changes, and then we have to figure out how to account for that. But, you know, a lot of what I talk about is already going on, and what I'm really trying to do is just bring this change in focus that's in the scientific field out into the public so we can all be charmed by it, I guess, because I find it really exciting. You know, that we're not just going to stand by and watch climate change ravage these species, that we're going to try to do something about it, that we're going to maybe even consider moving some species to places where they can survive better as the climate changes, that we're going to, you know, take responsibility for the world we've created.
More recently, you've been writing about wolves using a platform called Beacon. What's going on with wolves, and what is Beacon?
Well, Beacon is a crowdfunded journalistic platform. So the idea is it's kind of like Netflix. You can subscribe to a journalist that you're interested in for $5 a month, and then, you know, you can read all their stories. So it kind of cuts out the middleman of the magazine, so to speak. And I've been working on this wolf project. Originally I was going to write a book, and I may still do that, but I'm having a lot of fun just writing the individual stories. It started out as a sort of a related question. I was interested in whether the reintroduced wolves in the lower 48 states here could really be considered that wild, because so many of them have GPS tracking collars, and they have designated numbers, and we know where they are, and we know who their parents were, and we know who their pups are, and we're sort of, and if they get too close to livestock, we run around and shoot them with rubber bullets, and they seem to be living a life that's very well known, and that's kind of circumscribed by humans. And I was interested in sort of, where is the wildness in the wolf? Is it in his, you know, in the genome? Is it in the behavior? Is it in whether or not we know where they are? I mean, I often think about, you know, comparing the wolf that lives near me in Klamath Falls that has both a scientific designation and a nickname and a collar, and we know exactly where he is, and we know how many pups he has, and comparing that to some wolf in Alberta or BC far off into the mountains that's never seen a human and never will, it seems as if it's a different category. But as I've been writing the pieces, I've become really interested in the sort of eternal question of whether or not you can know what it's like to be another species, to be an animal. Of course, the answer is no, but that doesn't stop us from trying. And I've been writing the stories of individual wolves as much as I can piece them together through official records and collar data and so forth, and just trying to understand what it's like to be a wolf in the 21st century in a crowded part of the world, well, relatively speaking. So there's some wolves in Europe that live in some seriously crowded places, just on the outskirts of big cities in Italy and other parts of Europe, and that's a really fascinating setup.
Good Lord, what's next? Wolves with iPhones, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the idea that, you know, these biologists are getting text messages with updates of where these wolves are, it just seemed like such a paradox to me. Here's the icon of the wilderness, and it's sending you text messages. So I thought that was really interesting.
We're going to have to wrap it up there. From Klamath Falls, Oregon, our guest Emma Maris, and that's Maris with two R's, is the author of Rambunctious Garden, Saving Nature in a Post-Wild World. You can find out more at emmamaris.com, and you can also find links to her work and her recent article in Orion Magazine in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info, published every Wednesday. Emma, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. Find my links to conversations with Jeff Rubin and Emma Maris in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Thank you to all who friended this program on Facebook. We just crested over 25,000 listens on SoundCloud, gaining quickly. We now have more listeners in more countries. Hello to people in Scandinavia, Switzerland, Austria, Israel, Russia, India, and many more. There is a momentum now. It's not yet time to completely give up hope. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and thank you for caring about our world. We'll go out with my new song about disappearing species called She Did Not Say. Get it free from our SoundCloud page.
Dance around and go on. circle and say what you can. Circle and say what you can.